moving along, I'll ask for Marshall to call the next case, please.
Calling case number A190654, Cihabon Estate.
Just some remarks while you're settling in. Each of you has 15 minutes for your primary argument. An additional 5 minutes is reserved to appellant counsel for rebuttal if you choose to use that. When you're ready to proceed, appellant counsel, please approach the podium, introduce yourself, and indicate which party you're speaking on behalf of.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the court, my name is Jessica Merz-Gaddis, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Sunny Cihabon. Mr. Cihabon was convicted of aiding and abetting first-degree aggravated robbery, second-degree assault, and third-degree assault. The primary issue before this court today is whether the circumstantial evidence is sufficient to prove that Mr. Cihabon intentionally aided his accomplices in the commission of these crimes. Now, as this court is well aware, the first step of the analysis is to identify the circumstances proved. And on that point, I would say I generally agree with the circumstances proved as listed on pages 12 to 13 of respondent's brief. There's really not dispute there. The real issue for this court is that we disagree with respondent regarding how this court applies the second step of the standard of review. Again, as this court knows, the second step is you'll independently examine all the reasonable inferences from those circumstances proved. And the question for you is, do those circumstances proved exclude a reasonable hypothesis of innocence? Now, respondent at page 16 of his brief argues, there is simply no evidence to support an inference that either of the juvenile accomplices were physically capable of generating the kind of force necessary to cause the intracerebral hemorrhage the victim suffered. That, I submit to this court, is a misstatement of the standard. Properly stated, what this court is asking is, did the circumstances proved exclude a reasonable inference that either of those juvenile accomplices were physically capable of generating the force necessary to cause the injury? This, of course, makes sense because the burden is on the state. To be sufficient, the circumstances proved must exclude a reasonable inference that the defendant is not guilty. And here the circumstances proved simply do not. So this will bring us back to what we agree the circumstances proved are. The victim was looking.
The 13-year-olds could have bashed him in the head?
Yes, Your Honor, because the key question for you is, even accepting the size, the age and the size of the juveniles in this case, and even accepting that what the treating doctor testified to was, quote, a tremendous amount of force, unquote, was required to cause the injury.
But isn't one of the juveniles already out of the picture because the victim was looking at him, so that only leaves two people behind him?
No. I disagree with you on your understanding of what the circumstances proved are. So it is very clear that from the record that the victim is looking down at his phone when he is attacked, and he testifies very clearly he does not know who hit him. He doesn't know how he was hit. All he knows is that he looked down.
After he pushed up or pushed away the whatever it was, the weapon, whatever the
right.
Individual was holding.
Right.
But I thought he was facing that person because he
What we know from the record and what we agree on in terms of the circumstances proved, again, as listed in 12 to 13 of respondent's brief, is the victim is looking at the person who's pointing the gun at him at the time the person is pointing the, I should say, quote, gun, the item at him.
If we understand this.
Okay. So he's looking at him at that time, yes, and grabs onto it and pulls it down and says, get that away from me. But then what happens is he talks about he pulls out his phone and he from his pockets, and he looks down at his phone. And we don't have any evidence about exactly who is where at that point. Even assuming everybody is still standing in the exact same positions as they were when the accomplice was pointing the gun, the fact remains that what the victim says is he's looking down, and he doesn't know from which direction he's attacked. He doesn't know who hits him. He doesn't know where that blow comes from. He doesn't know what happens. All he knows is he blacks out.
So I guess what worries me, what I'm struggling with, is why isn't the fact, which we said you agree with, that, you know, the appellant started this by, you know, coming up and chest bumping the victim. I mean, this all happened pretty quickly, right? Chest bumped the victim, said, "What's your problem?" Explicitive. And then he turns around, and in a few seconds, he ends up with these injuries. Three people are all right there, close by. Why in the world isn't that enough to say the defendant intended his presence or action to further the commission of the crime?
So,
because he started it, right?
No. Again, I would disagree with how you're characterizing the circumstances proved. You made a reference there to that Mr. Sayavong said, "What's your problem?" We disagree that that is actually what he said. If you look back to what the victim testifies about, remember, these are all folks who know each other. They're all acquaintances.
Okay, and you said you agreed to pages 12 and 13. Though, so said something like, "Hey, what's up?" Explicitive, or "What's you up to?"
Right. Right. I do think later in the brief, I think what you're referring to is later in the brief, the respondent characterizes that phrase as "what's your problem." That's why I was very careful to say we agree with pages 12 to 13, because I think in their fact section, they accurately characterize the circumstances proved. I think they take some liberties and recast those circumstances proved in the argument section, and we don't agree with their characterization in that part of the brief. Because remember, all these folks are acquainted with each other. So what's clear here is that that Mr. Sayavong does anything aggressive in the encounter. There is the testimony about the chest bump, but in a greeting sort of way. And then remember, too, that what happens here is all that we know is that Mr. Sayavong is standing by while it's the clearly a co-defendant, an accomplice, who is the one who pulls the gun. And we know nothing more about what Mr. Sayavong does at that point. There's no allegation that there's any further activity on the part of Mr. Sayavong after that gun is pulled. I don't want to get too far away from the injury thing. If I could go back to that in a minute, but just to kind of stick on this point with this idea of what exactly is Mr. Sayavong doing here. I want to take you back and remember that the state argued here that there's no indication that there was some sort of pre-planning that this event was going to take place, that they were going to rob an individual, specifically this individual. There's no evidence before that of the jury at this time. So the state argued specifically below to the jury, and it doesn't dispute on appeal, there's no evidence of any kind of plan that these three people were looking to rob anyone, let alone this particular victim. So that gets to the point about there being no evidence that Mr. Sayavong knew that his accomplice was going to pull a gun and ultimately rob this victim. Now, going back to the injury part of it, when we're talking about the juvenile size and what the doctor's testimony is, I want to go back to that quote. The sole quote that we have from the doctor is, "tremendous amount of force required to cause the injury." Now, that's it. We don't know what a tremendous amount of force means. So even accepting the juvenile's age and size, there's no evidence here that they were incapable of generating whatever that amount of force was that was required to cause the injury.
Does the record indicate that the two 13-year-olds were shorter than the victim?
I don't believe it does. I believe the record only talks about their age and their weight. I don't remember if it talks about their height, but that's not coming to mind when I looked through the transcript yesterday.
Is there any, was the blow at the back of the head?
We don't know. And what all we know is the nature of the injury, that the nature of the injury was to what the doctor testified was intracerebral hemorrhage to the frontal lobe, which is at the front of the head. And then he talked about an injury to the temporal lobe, which he described as right by your ear. It wasn't specified whether it was a right ear or left ear, but he said right by your ear. And importantly, what the doctor did talk about in terms of the mechanism that can cause this kind of injury, he talked about how it could happen by somebody being kicked or punched, falling to the ground, and hitting their head on the ground to cause that kind of blunt force injury that we have here. So it's not, the doctor's testimony does not establish that it had to have been an actual strike to the head by a fist or a weapon or something that caused the blunt force injury. It could have. It's equally consistent with being knocked to the ground and hitting your head on the ground when you fall. So that's why the circumstances proved.
But I mean, could the evidence support, in the light most favorable to the verdict, that as he's looking down at the phone, that's when he got the bash.
That is. I think that is what the circumstances proved are, because that's what he testifies to. That's why he doesn't know what happened.
All right. What do you think of this? Generally speaking, 13-year-olds are shorter than 21 and 24-year-olds. Would that be a fair statement?
I think so.
Okay. So then, assuming it's harder to bash someone going like this than it is like going like that, you know. So generally speaking, taller people are better at bashing people than shorter people. So looking at the evidence in the light most favorable to verdict, why couldn't we say, well, the tall person, the only, you know, your client, it was more likely that when he was looking down at the phone, he was the one who bashed the victim on the head as opposed to the two 13-year-olds?
Well, because in this standard of review, it's not enough to just look at whether it's reasonably likely that the defendant is guilty. And I've conceded in the brief that a reasonable inference from these circumstances proved could very well be that Mr. Sayavong is the one that inflicted the blow. But that's not the end of the analysis. What we have to look at is, do the circumstances proved exclude a reasonable inference that he was not the one who did it, that it was one of the other two? And given the paucity of evidence that we have here about exactly how that blow was inflicted, the circumstances proved simply do not eliminate the reasonable hypothesis that it was one of the other two, because
even though they were shorter than the victim and your client was the taller one.
Right.
I guess why isn't that enough?
Because it sounds, Your Honor, like you're assuming that what happened is that this blow happened by an overhanded hit to the head. You're assuming that, but we don't know that. That's not a circumstance proved. The only circumstance proved here is the nature of the injury. And the nature of the injury is equally likely to have happened that way. It could have happened with a weapon. Somebody hit you over the head with some kind of an object. Or it could have happened by what the victim did describe as being punched and kicked as well, a fall to the ground and a smack your head as you hit the ground. So that, all of that, real absence, actually, of evidence in the case, that works to Mr. Sayavong's advantage, because the state's burden is to prove the circumstances proved that would exclude any reasonable inference of innocence here. And they simply did not do that, because we don't know precisely how this injury was inflicted. They want you to believe it was done as you've described, and perhaps it was. But the fact that we don't know that that's how the injury was inflicted works to the benefit of Mr. Sayavong under this standard of review.
Could I just turn your attention to the dangerous weapon issue that
you
raise as well? I just had a few questions. So, I mean, there was talk in the briefing about kind of, well, what did the victim think? Was it a, you know, toy gun or a BB gun? But isn't the analysis really, when looking at the definition of a dangerous weapon, it could be any instrumentality that, looking at how it's used or intended to be used, could likely or calculated to produce death or bodily harm? Because I looked at some cases that said everything from, I've got it somewhere here, you know, a metal lamp and, you know, scissors, dumbbells, even sometimes, you know, fists and feet can be dangerous weapons. Mm-hmm. So would you agree first that when we're looking at whether this is a dangerous weapon, we need to look at how it was intended to be used, and what happened there, which includes these pretty serious injuries?
I would agree with you that a BB gun may be a dangerous weapon under that third alternative definition of dangerous weapon. So I certainly don't agree with respondents' brief's analysis of why a BB gun would be. I agree with yours that it may be under the alternative, under the manner in which it is used, definition of a dangerous weapon. Having said all that, I think the bottom line for this case is that the state is fundamentally wrong when they say that they proved that it was a BB gun. What we have here is the victim who testified. I'm sorry, let me take one step back. At the absolute most, what the state proved was that the victim perhaps thought it was a BB gun. I'm going to take you to page 100 of the transcript. This is what the state is hanging their hat on. The question is, did you believe that the handgun that the accomplice was holding at the time was real under the circumstances? And the answer was, at the time, no, I was still under the impression that it was just a BB gun. So he just believes it may have been a BB gun in that statement of testimony. I've cited you then.
And the jury believed him, so why isn't that enough?
At best, what the jury could believe was that he thought it was a BB gun, not that it was a BB gun. Maybe it's a BB gun, I would tell this court, I would suggest to this court, is not proof beyond a reasonable doubt that it was a BB gun.
So, why is that important when we're looking at whether it is an instrumentality, whether it was a BB gun or not, that is calculated or likely to produce death, looking at how it's intended to be used?
Because you are assuming that it is a BB gun when you're thinking about the manner in which it is used. What I'm saying is if it's
I guess I was just assuming reading his testimony that maybe it was a BB gun or a handgun or it was something that looked like a gun.
Right, but
that's fair to assume reading his testimony, isn't it?
Right, and I would suggest that what this court needs to do, and I'll wrap up real quick, I see my time is up, is looking at his entire testimony, which is cited for you in my brief, but I'll tell you now, it's pages, what I read to you just now was 100, pages 101, 103, and 105. Those are all the places where he talks about it as a toy gun. So I think the fair reading of his testimony, he explains the reason why he had the nerve to grab it and pull it out of his face is because he thought it was a toy. So if it's a toy, I would submit to the court that it's not going to qualify as a dangerous weapon because a toy, in the manner a toy is used, is not capable of causing death or great bodily harm. Thank you.
May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Travis Smith. I represent Respondent State of Minnesota in this appeal. The district court correctly denied the petition for post-conviction relief for three reasons. First, there are no rational inferences inconsistent with appellant's guilt because the circumstances proved demonstrate that only appellant had the ability and was in the position to have inflicted the injuries the victim sustained. Second, appellant's argument that the evidence is insufficient to prove that Chiovale had a dangerous weapon is meritless because the jury, based on the evidence presented, believed, in light of the verdict, that he possessed a BB gun, which is a dangerous weapon.
Where is it in the record that the defendant was taller and the two 13-year-olds are shorter?
The heights of the two 13-year-olds are in the record.
How tall are they?
They're 4'5" and between 4'10" and 5'.
Where is it in the record how tall the defendant is?
So there is no testimony in the record, but I would remind the court that the jury had the opportunity to view both the defendant and the victim when they're present in the courtroom, and that's something that the cold transcript doesn't reflect, but those are part of the trial, and the jury certainly is in a position to view and assess those things, and I think it's reasonable to give deference to those assessments based on the verdict. It would certainly be better for the state if that testimony had been elicited at trial. I don't make any argument there.
I think there's some support for what you're just saying, so lucky you.
Third and finally...
Now how do we get to... he was the one who bashed the victim.
Sure. And I think when we look at the circumstances proved as a whole, and as the courts noted, this all happened pretty fast. And what I think I would point to is the fact that when the victim is looking down at his phone, he blacks out immediately, which I think is a circumstance that demonstrates that his blacking out and not knowing what happened was a result of a blow delivered somewhere where he could not see it. And I think that's the only rational inference consistent with that testimony. Because if he fell down and then struck his head, presumably he would remember falling down. He also in response to a question on cross-examination, affirmed that he told the officer he'd been struck from behind. And again, that makes sense because he wasn't able to say specifically who struck him. And if somebody in front of him had struck him, he would remember that.
Right, but now, you know, and not, or I should say, anticipating Abel Appellant's counsel, she's going to say, yup, but it's the rational alternative hypothesis, so why do we absolutely get to exclude that the two 13-year-olds couldn't have done it? I mean, if he's looking down, I mean, I suppose the argument is, well, he's that much closer, so that they, one of the two 13-year-olds who are short, you know, can bash him on the head.
Well, I think we have to remember that we have to look at the circumstances proved as a whole and not take them into isolation, take any individual fact in isolation. And the other thing is, the state was only required to prove that appellant aided and abetted the commission of this offense. And these, the testimony of the victim is that they surrounded him. Dow was in front of him. When the blow was delivered, the appellant was behind him, and the other 13-year-old was off to the side.
I heard that was I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I thought that was disputed by appellant counsel because I asked that question, weren't they behind him? And she said, no. Evidence of that.
I think there is absolutely evidence of that. That was the victim's testimony of the positions of the individuals as the events happened. Dow pointed the gun at him. He
pushed it away, but then
pushed it away.
Looked down at his phone.
No, and he had turned around. So let's back up. The appellant approached the victim. There was the chest bump, which the victim specifically refused to characterize as a greeting. So I think that demonstrates that the victim believed it was hostile. And we have to remember that we're examining a jury verdict here, and a jury who heard direct testimony about these things. So the appellant approaches the victim, is hostile, and I think that's, based on the verdict, I think that's a reasonable characterization of the testimony. And then, after that, he turns around. And so now the appellant is behind him. There's no testimony that the positions changed. There's no testimony. There's no, that the appellant didn't contest the positions of the individuals at trial. He simply argued we don't know who caused the actual injury. So I believe that the jury, in light of the evidence presented and in light of their verdict, believed that that was the position of the individuals when the offense was committed. And that evidence is in the transcript. I think that's among the circumstances proved.
Coming back to kind of your earlier point, look, we didn't have to prove that he was the one who delivered the blows because this is, after all, accomplice liability. But that gets me to the kind of first principle under accomplice liability, that the defendant knew that his alleged accomplices were going to commit a crime when the prosecutor, well, and maybe that was you, I just don't recall the dream, said in the closing arguments that admitted they didn't have a plan going into this.
Well, the prosecutor in closing admitted that there was no evidence of a plan. That's, I think that's a different concession. Also, we don't know, this is a statement in a closing argument. I don't know how much weight we're going to hang on this as a concession, but I would point out that we don't have to prove premeditation here, and even premeditation could be momentary. We don't have to prove a conspiracy. So I think when the individuals surround the victim, that demonstrates a certain coordination of behavior and suggests and demonstrates a knowing what's going on. So I don't believe that it's reasonable based on the facts and the record here to conclude that the defendant at no point in time had any idea that a crime was going to be committed. There's evidence based on his behavior and the way he interacted with the other individuals and with the victim that they were acting in concert to commit the crime of robbery. Essentially, the appellant's arguing because we don't know who committed the, we couldn't convict a principal of robbery and third degree assault, that he can't be convicted of aiding and abetting. Effectively, that's what it comes down to here. And this isn't the first kind of robbery case like this that's come before this court. There's unpublished decisions dealing with these sorts of circumstances, and it's clear from the record that this is what's going on. The circumstances proved demonstrate that the appellant and his accomplices surrounded the victim, preventing his escape effectively, and he was struck so severely that he instantly blacked out and suffered an intracerebral hemorrhage and a concussion. And again, the relative size of the accomplices here simply makes it incredible to believe. It's not rational to believe that one of the 13-year-olds caused the injuries resulting in the concussion and the blacking out, given the other facts.
Do we have to believe that in order to say the evidence was sufficient?
No, we certainly don't. We don't have to believe that it was the appellant who actually caused the injuries to believe that the evidence is sufficient. We know that acting in concert, these three individuals caused these injuries and took the victim's property. And that demonstrates beyond a reasonable doubt and excludes all rational inferences inconsistent with the appellant's guilt. I'd like to point out, in addition to the height, there's also evidence of the weight of the juveniles. One of them weighed only 57 pounds. That's astonishingly small. And there's others. It's worth bearing out that the victim described his face as busted in. His face was swollen, badly bruised, and beaten. And to believe that all of this happened while the appellant stood passively by simply is not rational.
Unless he was so shocked that he couldn't believe two 13-year-olds had that much strength to bash the guy. I mean, you know, there's some tough 13-year-olds out there.
There certainly are.
I mean, because it's either he bashed them or he was simply there while they were bashing him, but mere presence alone is not enough. So what else? If he didn't bash them and all he did was be there while they bashed him, how is that enough to convict him of aiding and abetting?
And I don't believe that
we believe there was no plan and it just happened spontaneously, and you know, maybe he was shocked as the defendant or the victim. Excuse me.
I think that that's not a legitimate option based on the evidence here, his mere passive presence, because of first the fact of the way he initiated contact with the victim, and then the fact that they're acting in concert demonstrates that. There's also, among the circumstances proved, the fact that the victim, all he remembers is waking up in his own bed. Somehow he got there.
Well, I mean, I don't know. He got bashed, and then somehow he got to his bed. I mean, are you suggesting we're supposed to believe that these three people took him to the room? What?
I certainly believe that's a reasonable inference that somebody took him home.
What evidence?
Based on the fact that he blacked out and wasn't able to get there and doesn't remember getting there. And that's not...
Maybe some good Samaritan took him home. I don't know. What's all that about?
Nothing's in the record.
So right. There's nothing on the... I would agree we're venturing off into speculation, but the venturing off into speculation cuts both ways, because the inferences inconsistent with defendant's guilt can't be mere speculation either. They have to be based on the facts in the record, and they can't be... Then they have to account for all of the facts in the record. That's the other thing. They have to account for all of the circumstances proved. If an inference doesn't account for all of the circumstances proved, it's not a rational inference in a given case. Just because we could conjure it up doesn't mean that it's rational in this particular case in light of all of the facts.
So if I could just ask you about the lesser included issue. Looking at the State versus Hackler, doesn't that decide the issue that count six is an lesser included of count five? I mean, you seem to say in a footnote in your brief that because it's an order opinion, it suggests somehow it's not precedential. And do you have any authority for that?
I thought it was pretty careful with my footnote. I don't intend to suggest that Hackler's not precedential. I have a couple of points. First of all, I don't believe that the argument that I'm advancing about the permissive nature of the language of 609.4 is an argument that's ever been made. I think that's a question of first impression, and I see no evidence that the Supreme Court has actually interpreted the language of 609.04. Hackler is a precedential opinion. Quite frankly, I believe it's wrongly decided based on the plain language of the statute. And I understand that if this court feels that Hackler controls the question presented here, that it's obligated to follow that. I've got to preserve my arguments. But I also think that the fact that we're talking about aiding and abetting is a significant point here. Because aiding and abetting under the statute, under Section 609.05, is intended to provide broad liability for the acts of accomplices. If 609.04, effectively, what I would suggest is that the appellant's liability for aiding and abetting second-degree assault is the result of a different criminal act, of a different criminal actor, than his liability is for aiding and abetting third-degree assault, which was committed by committed by a different criminal actor. And if we're to give meaning and effect to the broad liability articulated in 609.05 for accomplice liability, saying that you can't be convicted for the actions of all of your accomplices doesn't do that. It renders the broad liability of 609.05 hollow to say that. So I think that's one way that even if Hackler says that when we're based on the same criminal act, these are lesser included offenses, the state can still prevail on the issue here because we have different criminal acts by different criminal actors. I see my time has expired. I'd ask this court to affirm the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Your Honors, just to be clear, the reason that I addressed my argument today towards talking about the circumstances proved and whether it excluded a reasonable inference that Mr. Saivong was the principal is because the state's brief focuses entirely on arguing that Mr. Saivong was the principal in this case, therefore there's no reasonable inference that he's not guilty. I think it's interesting that now in the argument they pivoted somewhat away from that and tried to shift the focus back to accomplice liability. What I still don't hear an argument about is I agree this is an accomplice liability case, and what that means is what the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, if he's not the principal, is that he knew that a crime was going to be committed and that he intended his presence to further the commission of the crime. And I think it's telling that now the state is stepping back from their earlier concession that there's no evidence here that there was any kind of plan that this was going to happen. I mean, they acknowledged in their case, they did not prove that there was any kind of plan involving these three people and this one victim. So right there, that I think establishes, and you don't have to just take their concession at trial. You can look at the record yourself and see that there is, in fact, no evidence that there was any kind of pre-planning there. So there's no circumstances proved that establish that Mr. Saivong knew that a crime was going to be committed. And all the circumstances proved show is that he was present when this crime began happening. There's absolutely nothing that excludes the reasonable inference that he was merely surprised when, indisputably, it's his co-defendant that pulls this item out and points it in the face of the victim. And we know nothing further about what happens after that with respect to Mr. Saivong's conduct. In other words, all we know is he's just standing there. He's present when suddenly this decision, this situation erupts. Recall that the phone that is stolen is found in the second accomplice's, the third person's possession. So we don't have any circumstance proved here that eliminates the reasonable hypothesis that he, Mr. Sayavong, did not intend by his presence to further the commission of the crime. With respect to, again, the victim's
It was the chest bump that got the whole thing going. And I agree. Okay, so there's no plan, but, you know, things happen very quickly sometimes with crimes, and it's sort of like, you know, so the other two are there, he bumps him, you know, maybe then he's distracted, the other guy pulls the gun out, he starts looking down, you know, at that point, you know, and I agree mere presence is not enough, but, you know, the gun's out, you know, why isn't that sort of enough?
I think all that that does is loop us back to it may be reasonable that the inference that Mr. Sayavong did knowingly and intentionally participate in the crime, it may be, but it doesn't exclude the reasonable inference that he did not. Just quickly with respect to this issue, the third issue
but
that's...
So you don't buy the one of them took him home and it was probably your guy?
No. Well, you know, I mean, on that point, I think that that also just speaks to the fact that what I tried to articulate in my primary argument, that we don't know, we all seem to be assuming that it was just a single bash that knocked him out, and the state wants the court to believe that that's what happened and that it couldn't have possibly been done by one of the 13-year-olds. I think when you read all of the victim's testimony here, what he clearly establishes is that he does not know what happened. He doesn't have any memory of anything related to that event until he wakes up in his bed. And as we've said here, clearly he got home somehow. He doesn't know how. The point I'm trying to make here is that I think that that goes to support the idea that it wasn't necessarily just one bash that knocked him out. There could have been something else going on. It could have been the other two accomplices inflicting a more sustained beating before the blackout happened, and then he doesn't remember anything. The fact that we don't know exactly what happened to cause his injury, again, works to Mr. Sayavong's advantage, not the state's, because it's the state's burden to prove the circumstances, to prove that would eliminate a reasonable inference that Mr. Sayavong is not guilty, and that's what they failed to do. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for appearing today and arguing in support of your briefs. A decision will be issued in the statutory 90-day time frame. Thank you.